The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is rusjournal.com. That's rusjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of the Orthodox Medievalist. Today we're going to continue to talk about Ukraine, but something I think that might be of more interest to the general listener here, I'm going to talk about a book that came out back in 99 or 2000. It is a collection of writings from the Ukrainian nationalist group called the OUN in English, or the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. I actually knew members of the OUN when I was in grad school living amongst the Ukrainian diaspora. And so a lot of this material was written during the Second World War. I actually have personal experience in terms of listening to these people and hearing their stories about what the OUN was all about, both as a counter-revolutionary movement against the National Socialists of Germany and the International Socialists of the Soviet Union. There are three essays in particular here that I want to talk about, and I want you guys to think about very clearly concerning World War II, Ukrainian nationalism, and nationalism in general. The first is really about the Germans in Ukraine, that is to say the German army in Ukraine after the first invasion by Korienko, the nature of the state by Poltava, and lastly a look at our attitude towards the Russian people by Horovy. These are probably all pseudonyms, of course. But the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists was a fairly large, fairly well-armed a movement that had the backing of the majority of the Ukrainian people. And I know from secondhand, from people who I know, who I lived among, the Polovskis and the Lechalats and the Starokans and other families that I lived with in grad school, they are pretty clear that the OUN was representative of the Ukrainian population. They were both anti-Nazi and anti-communist, and they believed in an independent and an Orthodox Ukraine. So today I want to talk about these three essays in particular, and in the process of doing that, to, number one, lay out really what these people were all about, what the real militant nationalism of the Ukrainian people is all about, and was all about, and should still be today, and really what was the Ukrainian nationalist position concerning the German invasion of the USSR. I mean, we know their position concerning the Soviet Union. That's simple enough. But concerning the German invasion, that's another matter altogether. So, first of all, we're going to deal with the essay by I.M. Kovalenko. And, you know, we've got to keep in mind that we're talking about a mentality that probably comes from Alfred Rosenberg and Himmler and guys like this more than it does from Adolf Hitler. But the first thing that the OUN had made very clear in all of its publications is that this concept of living space, Hitler's idea of living space, is absolutely unacceptable. At the very least, Himmler's idea of living space is absolutely unacceptable. That the German National Socialists were in fact internationalists in the Ukrainian position because they had no problem with eliminating Slavic peoples so as to make room for those from Germany and elsewhere, refusing to believe that the Slavs were in any way Indo-European. And in fact, Himmler was, of course, a pagan, as was Alfred Rosenberg. And these guys held to kind of a mythical notion that the Slavic peoples were, in fact, of Mongol stock. And there really is not tons of evidence for that. But the first point we need to make here is that the OUN, the Ukrainian Nationalist Movement, representing a very large portion of the Ukrainian population in the 40s and then later on, is the idea that Livenstrom is absolutely out of the question. And that, you know, the very reasonable demand that the OUN made to the German high command was that there is nothing wrong, especially as the war starts going badly, of taking Ukrainian national opinion into account. And the OUN accused Rosenberg, Hitler, Himmler, the ideological people, not so much the military people, but the ideological backbone of the National Socialist Party in Germany, for really not taking Ukrainian opinion into consideration. And here's something that I've been saying for years and years and years. Hitler would have won World War II and would have destroyed the Soviet Union had he listened to the OUN, had he taken Russian and especially Ukrainian opinion into consideration rather than considering them subjects of some kind of German empire. The OUN makes the claim that the Germans have terrorized Ukraine. The Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists says that not only has the ideological movement of National Socialism not taken Ukraine seriously as a nation or as a people, but in fact has done a great amount of damage, not only to Ukraine as a society, as an economic entity, but certainly done a lot of damage to Ukraine as an anti-communist force. And it's conceivable that a lot of the pro-Marxist ideas that came in the 1950s after Stalin's purges derived from the fact that the NS movement did nothing to help the Ukrainians. And the OUN and Kovalenko and other writers who are eyewitnesses to all of this at the time, of course, claim that the Germans terrorized the Ukrainian population. And they condemn the idea that they take, derives both from Himmler and from Alfred Rosenberg, that somehow the Germans are destined to move to the east. And the OUN's position is that we're quite willing to cooperate with any political movement that wants to preserve and strengthen Ukrainian independence and culture, and yet this is not the mentality of Himmler, or at the very least, is certainly not the mentality of the SS and the ideological units attached to the German army. You'll notice that in a lot of these writings, the German army itself is not a problem. The German army has a tendency to treat the Ukrainians fairly well. It's the ideological core. It's the SS. It's these people coming from Frank, from Rosenberg, from Himmler. These are the problem. And one of the things that the OUN claims, and again, this is from eyewitnesses, that the Germans are engaging in mass deportations. Now, of course, I lived among the Polosky family in Lincoln, Nebraska, and they were one of these deportees. So I know this for a fact, And just talking to my, you know, they're very, very, very dear friends of mine, Olga and Vladimir, now in their late 80s, and they say, yes, mass deportations were the norm. You know, instead of building up a strong Ukraine as a bulwark against the Soviet Union, the Germans did everything they could to humiliate the Ukrainian population. And that the OUN says that, you know, in their behavior and in their ideology, this movement that has invaded the Soviet Union is in fact a pagan and not a Christian movement. They claim to be Christians when they show up in Ukrainian villages. And many of the rank and file German soldiers are in fact Christians in one form or another. But again, the ideological core, this elite ideological core is pagan, and therefore we cannot trust them. The OUN says that really Himmler and Rosenberg seek nothing more than to exploit Ukraine and to dismember her, and in giving places like Transdniestria to Romania is proof of this. That traditional Ukrainian lands being given away to various allies, it's doing nothing but harming the anti-communist cause. And, you know, it's almost like, and Kovalenko almost, you know, tongue-in-cheek says that the SS will really only be satisfied in Ukraine only insofar as they're able to make them all Germans or eliminate them. And there's simply no way that, of course, this is going to happen. And in some way, the Germans are under the impression that in order to function at all, that the Ukrainians need strong German leadership. And the OUN and other nationalist groups throughout the country are saying, we're this leadership, and we are willing to cooperate, but the Germans, in fact, are the ones who are not willing to cooperate, based on a cockamamie racial theory that holds that Slavs are not white people. And this is a constant complaint within and among the OUN. That the Germans are working the Ukrainian peasants to death. I also have first-hand testimony in my interviews in the past that this is the case, that the Germans behave in Ukraine no differently than Stalin did. They treat the peasants as cattle and are working them to death. And here's something that a lot of people don't know. And that is that Himmler and Rosenberg, and frankly, I'm not sure who it is, but somebody within the ideological elite of the SS movement, created their own version of the collective farm. And it is called the community farm. And the OUN, of course, does quite a bit to harm these community farms. These community farms are functionally no different than the collective farms of the Soviet Union. They're run by party officials. They're run on the very same basis. And here's a curious claim. The OUN makes the claim that the Germans, in order to harm the religious cohesion of the Ukrainian people, are bringing in Baptist missionaries. They are financing and feeding and housing Baptist missionaries and using them against Orthodox populations throughout the Ukraine. Now, I have not heard that particular charge before, but in the underground writings of the OUN, that charge is made at least by one person. And finally, in the critique of the German occupation of Ukraine by Kovalenko, he also claims that everything that the Germans had promised, so far as Ukrainian life is concerned, have been revoked. The Germans are closing Orthodox churches. They are not reopening them. They might reopen them as a symbolic measure, But they close them immediately when it becomes clear that these churches are, they're not just places of worship. They're also places of political agitation, of community building, of cadre building. They become sources of OUN recruitment. And so they close the churches as much as they open them. At the same time, whenever an independent Ukrainian press regardless of the particular ideological point of view is opened, the German authorities will shut it down. So, needless to say, I am not a national socialist in the German sense. I might be a social nationalist in the kind of universal sense. But I believe Kovalenko, and I believe the first-hand accounts that I have heard personally in my interviews in grad school amongst the people who I lived with, some of whom are still alive, and some of whom are talking to me on a regular basis, that these charges are true. And they amount to a treatment of the Ukrainian population no different than that of Stalin. It may have been less systematic, but the fact is that no matter what your political ideology happens to be, the German forces did everything in their power to anger a large, militant, literate, intelligent Ukrainian population against them. They could have been used against the USSR, and frankly, the world would have been a lot different. People like Rosenberg and Himmler were rotten people, and that is proven by their genocidal tactics in Ukraine, and not only genocidal but just ignorant. And I think a lot of people still have some of these prejudices concerning the Ukrainian population. The next essay that is worth talking about is something a bit more abstract, something a bit more theoretical. Really showing that the OUN during the war was very literate and quite aware of different trends in philosophy and political theory. The author, of course, it's a pseudonym, P. Poltava, given the historic significance of Poltava, Peter the Great and Mazepa and everything else. It's clearly a pseudonym. I'm pretty sure all of these essays are done under pseudonyms, but I'm still, regardless of that, I still hold, generally speaking, that these are representative of the Ukrainian people as a whole. And I know that the Polovskis, in our many conversations, very painful to them personally, by the way, that they say that the OUN was popular and that the OUN represented Ukrainians from central western Ukraine and even the Ukrainians living in Poland and Austria. It's called The State and concerns this has been a big issue in my career, the relationship between the ethnic group and the state. I have a reputation of holding that the state and the ethnic group are two, not only separate things, but opposite things. And the national anarchist movement, something that I have some sympathy with, and that you see within the Ukrainian movement of people like Drahomanov, for example, there's a lot of sympathy there, that the state and the ethnos are antagonistic. Remember, the old Marxist absurdity is that the state came into existence only to protect already developing economic inequalities amongst people. More realistically, the OUN's position and my position is that the state comes into existence in ancient times as a method of defense. A group of people become settled and form their economy, and as a result of this, they form a state because they are surrounded by nomadic groups possibly seeking to pillage them. And therefore, the state derives largely as a military apparatus rather than that is directed outward rather than as a security apparatus directed inward, as the communists had held. But people like Poltava in these essays also hold that, even if there were no external threats, the state would still be necessary to order society and to keep people in their proper places, at least in terms of the division of labor. the necessary labor, what needs to be done to run a society. Now, the OUN is a social nationalist group. They hold that the ethnic group and the nation are primary, but that part of that solidarity implies a great degree of economic equality and a great degree of economic cooperation and socialism among its members. But that's not, I mean, you know, the idea of inequality is not the basis of the state. The OUN holds to the view, generally speaking, that economic exploitation, that came later. That came after the state had already began to function and began to serve its role as the chief protector, the army, the militia, against external threats. But they say something else. And it's something else I think that all nationalists really have to hold, and is one that I hold personally. The opposite of the national state is the multinational state. The multinational state is an empire. The national state is an ethnic group that has built up a security apparatus to protect itself from outside forces. And of course, the OUN is holding that it is this security apparatus. The OUN holds that nations are the highest form of human society. And I want to say that this is true. What he's saying is that there are various ways that human beings, as peoples, can be organized. They can be organized in villages. They can be organized in guilds and unions. They could be organized in terms of huge empires like in Poland or in Tsarist Russia. Even in religious terms, they could be organized as large groups, you know, Hindus or whatever it is. But the OUN holds that it is the nation that is able to take all of these concepts into itself and synthesize them. That the nation is small enough to be governable, but large enough to be self-sufficient. It is something that is morally unified through language and its own history and sufferings. So nations are the highest expression of political life. They're the highest expression of solidarity that is capable of defending itself. Where villages really cannot defend themselves, they're just too small. The nation is large enough to do this, and again, the OUN holds that, you know, this is kind of what we do here. And so, if that's true, or if that's even partially true, then free national states making up, you know, this diverse world. Free national states based on language and tradition, this is the ultimate ethical end of politics. And I will say that I agree with this, and most nationalist movements throughout the world, no matter where they are, happen to agree with that concept. That the nation as ethnicity is the highest expression of unity and solidarity that is feasible. I mean, you cannot love everybody in the world. Globalism and cosmopolitanism is so absurd. The nation is the extended family, so to speak. The nation connects like the family in the same way where families go through sufferings and they go through hard times and they come through it closer and more deeply in love with each other. And it's the same thing with nations. They go through suffering. They go through times of famine and oppression and everything else. But when they come out of that, what does it mean? It means they're much stronger. They're much more willing to sacrifice. They see that their own will can only function as part of the general will of the people, speaking the same language and holding to the same religion and holding to the same basic moral tradition. Again, I'm speaking very generally here, but that's the case. And it's something that the OUN and really I think most nationalists will hold as the case. And so therefore, what is the purpose of international relations? What is the purpose of war? What is the purpose of our economic life? All of this, ethically speaking, is to bring about a world order of independent, integral national states. The central truth of nationalism as a philosophical notion is that the independent ethnostate creates conditions for community, for cooperation, for real friendship that manifests in what Aristotle will call the good life. It is the main moral foundation for development. We need to see each other, even if we're strangers. We've never seen each other before, but when we come across each other, we see each other as friends and brothers because we come from the same ethnos. We come from the same family. Our ancestors have been through the same suffering. Our ancestors have been through the same pain. We know the same language. We sing the same songs. We drink the same drinks. We worship in the same way. This is what nations are. They are extended families. And that nations, because of this solidarity, and that's the social in the concept of social nationalism. A nationalism is only national if it is truly social and based on equality and solidarity and friendship. And again, friendship in Aristotle and Cicero's sense of the word. That these nations continuously working together, this is the foundation of the constant growth of a people's material and spiritual culture. So this is really the idea of the organization of Ukrainian nationalists in the midst of fighting World War II. And therefore, it's something that we need to take seriously as a philosophical idea, as something that is to be, you know, that something that is true. That it is the ethnos, that extended family, speaking the same language, worshiping the same, having the same basic moral structure. Even if we're not of the same blood, I mean, I'm not of Ukrainian stock. I'm Irish and I have a small amount of Hungarian in me from my grandfather, Kosciuszko. But I've adopted the Ukrainian tradition and know more about it than most Ukrainians do. So this is not necessarily about DNA. We're not talking about DNA here. We're talking about solidarity and belonging. We're talking about where our minds truly fit for whatever reason. And it's these connections, these devotions, these loves that produce civic life. Institutions and economies and guns and everything else, all of this only matters if it first manifests itself in the ethnos, in the way that we have defined it. We're not talking about the state here. We're talking about the extended family. We'll be right back. Hang in there.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on The Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Let's return to The Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Okay, folks, welcome back. We are talking about a group called the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. And it's been a very positive development where you have a book that's been out now for about a decade concerning the political writings of the Ukrainian underground, that is to say the OUN, as it has written its different ideological and social ideas throughout World War II up until the 1950s. And by the way, and I think I've said this before on this program, the OUN did not go away. It continued to function throughout the 50s, 60s, 70s, and onward. In fact, the great venerable patriarch Vladimir of Kiev, from whom I take my own priestly orders as an Orthodox priest and liturgist, he himself was a member of the OUN. So I'm very proud of that, that I actually come spiritually from this movement. But the OUN's position, I think, is a very consistent one and is a defensible one. We don't like the Nazis because the Nazis think that we are essentially third world people. We don't like the Soviets because not only are the Soviets genocidal, but they don't even believe that we're Ukrainians. The OUN says, therefore, and this is, you know, pretty common within the Ukrainian idea, that an independent social nationalist Ukraine can provide for independence, can provide for economic solidarity, and a basic sense of social equality. There is no nationalism without basic social equality. The idea of solidarity, the idea of worker control over industries, worker control over farms and farmsteads, the redistribution of land, the expropriation of the rich, something certainly that I hold to. I don't see any reason why anybody in the world needs to make more than $1 million a year. For heaven's sakes, for what purpose? But the basis of that is not some fackle Marxist or anarchist idea, but those things that people have fought and died for. That is to say, the family, the nation, the locality, the people, hearth, and home. These are the things that people fight and die for, and that, therefore, is the basis of a true social revolution, and that, in turn, is at the basis of social nationalism. So I want to talk about one last essay in this book and something very dear to me because, you know, I am both a Russian and a Ukrainian nationalist. And some might consider that a little strange. There's nothing strange about it. Alexander Solzhenitsyn is both a Russian and or was both a Russian and a Ukrainian nationalist. It simply is to say that Great Russia should maintain its own territory in the central areas around Moscow, Novgorod, Pskov, and that Ukraine should maintain its traditional ethnic territory around Lvov, Kiev, and Kharkiv. There's nothing really bizarre about that. It's simply people with specific historically conditioned cultures living on their traditional territory and making matters really more painful for us that in the Russian-Ukrainian case, they're really held together by the devotion of the Orthodox world. I mean, at least when you're talking about England and Ireland, you're talking about two different religions. I mean, at least so even there you have no real basis. But in Ukraine and Russia, you have this devotion to Jesus Christ that should be binding them together rather than separating them. And maybe this radio show can do a little tiny speck of a little bit to help heal that. But there is an article in this collection by O. Hororvi dealing with our attitude towards the Russian people. You notice he doesn't say the Russian state. He doesn't say the Soviet Union. He says the Russian people. And the first thing he says is that the people are only represented when the truth about their origins are actually truthfully represented and understood. The Ukrainian historical development is very different from the Russian historical experience and development, regardless of similarities in religion. So what? That doesn't mean we cannot be friends, but it does mean that we are two different peoples. That all peoples are to have national states that would include great Russians as well as Ukrainians, Belarusians, Poles, and everybody else. Really, the OUN approaches the Soviet Union the same way that it approaches Nazi Germany. This is not a matter of building an empire. This is a matter of reaching a moral goal where the entire world is divided up into relatively small ethno-states dedicated to a common culture, language, and economic equality and solidarity. Empires are not justified. Empires are not justifiable because they are based all on the same thing, namely the concept of exploitation. Nationalism, and this is a very important point, nationalism does not lead to national isolation. This has never been the case historically. But the reality of the world divided up into national states leads to cooperation. It leads to the creation of voluntary ties based on the closeness of the peoples, based on the trading relationships that peoples can develop without ever harming the ethnographical nature of the people. This is not about negating the other. This is about saying that Ireland should have its own state, England should have its own, Serbia should have its own, Croatia should have its own. So instead of fighting over one pie, they should be content with their own pies and then trade with one another for the sake of expanding it based on the concept, generally speaking, of comparative advantage. Nationalism, in its true sense, is infinitely better for world peace than internationalism or globalism or empire. I should remind you that World War I was not fought among national states. It was fought among empires. The Russian Empire, the German Empire, the Austrian Empire, the Turkish Empire, the British Empire. World War II was not fought among national states, but the Soviet Empire, the German Empire, the British Empire. The Cold War was not fought among national states, but between the Soviet and American empires with a little bit of the Chinese Empire. Wars are created by empires. Furthermore, there's another ethical idea here, and it should be taken seriously by you guys, that the national economy and a social nationalist system is based for the people. It's based for the nation. It is labor, whether it be intellectual or blue collar, that should be in charge of electing and maintaining control over their bosses and their managers. That the economy belongs to the people, not to the owners and not to the states. And the way that states function in the modern world are as mini empires. The blue collars and the farmers work to enrich, at least in America, that 1% of the population who controls over 90% of the American wealth. And this is the kind of crap that these filthy degenerates like Rush Limbaugh and the Fox News people and the neoliberals are continually defending. Nationalism is about economic equality, and economic equality is based on the solidarity of peoples. Think about it in terms of family life. Any good family wants their sons and daughters to go out into the world with equal opportunities, with the same educations, with the same backgrounds. Why wouldn't a nation function any differently? It's not to say that inequalities cannot exist due to superior talent. That's not the issue here. But the elites that exist in the 20th and now the 21st century are a-national and anti-national. And that's why every year at the Bilderberg meetings, thanks to my good friend Jim Tucker, the American Free Press, the super elite at the Bilderberg meeting say that our number one enemy is nationalism. It's not socialism. Socialism just means that all the money then goes to the party. That's all socialism ever meant. The productive capacity of the world should go to the party and to its leadership. No, nationalism is about distribution of land, of power, and of control. If democracy is so good in politics, how come it can't be good in economics? Next time you come across some half-witted neoliberal or neoconservative, why don't you ask him that? If I could vote for my president, how come I can't vote for my boss? Why is that such a problem? And so that's the nature here, really, of the organization of Ukrainian nationalists and their writings in the 1940s and 1950s. There's much we can learn from this as to what nationalism is, social nationalism is, as a political ideology, as a social movement, as an ethical movement. And it's something that I want you to think about as we develop our own ways out of this rotten, disgusting capitalist system. We could only hope that the destruction of lives, millions of American lives being destroyed, hardworking peoples being destroyed. Remember, you know, when the economy collapses, so does healthcare, and so do families, because they're always fighting about money. How do we build our own institutions? How can we build our own institutions in such a way that we can pool our resources and ignore the regime? Take your television and smash it. Build yourself up physically, because in building yourself up physically, you will build yourself up mentally. Continue to read, continue to listen. Do everything in your power to find a mate and to raise strong Christian European traditional children, because that's what I'm doing. And it's a struggle, but God will reward you, and He'll be there for you, as He's been for me. I've been through the ringer in this system. I've been fired from jobs. I've been threatened with everything. And yet, somehow, my family has come through it, and they've come through it stronger and more moral than had it not occurred. So I beg of you to consider all of this, to consider the nationalist movements throughout the world and how we can imitate them. How we can create these non-violent sort of organizations where we can assist each other financially. We can assist each other with mortgage payments and tax payments and food and even childcare if absolutely necessary. Can we do this? Yes, we can. And I'm willing to help. I'm willing to help here in southern Pennsylvania, and I know that there are people who are willing to help all over the place. Stop selling things. Stop trying to make a buck off of everybody. Just put out your stuff for free. Start building up a movement. Building up a movement where we could all pool our resources and then build our own national and ethnic life. and ask only that we be left alone. It's been done. The Amish do it. The Amish do it right in my neighborhood. If they could do it, we can do it. And all we can do is continue to suffer, because this is a time of suffering. We can continue to suffer, but that suffering can be an engine for our rehabilitation and regeneration. We can suffer, we could pray, we can do what we can to build our own institutions and to live our lives the way that we are supposed to and to raise our children that way. So I leave you with that. I will hopefully have you back as my friends and guests next time. Again, if you need to contact me, I'm at FatherRaphael@yahoo.com. That's FR_Raphael@yahoo.com. I normally am not on the computer. I mean, I'm on, you know, once in a while, but I don't normally read blogs or anything like that. If you have a compliment or a critique or something to say, please contact me that way, and I'll get back to you as soon as possible. Anyway, thank you, God bless, and good night.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Radio Aryan.